Hi, everybody. My name is Jason Brush. I oversee user experience design at an agency called Schematic. We are a marketing services company, and we focus a lot on innovative work across multi-platform interaction design. So today I'm going to be talking about designing touch interfaces for public environments and about the ways in which that differs a little bit from how you might design a touch interface for a tablet or for a mobile device, which is very much a personal experience and not something that you do in public in front of other people, right? Let's see if this is working. There, yes, working. So I'm going to talk about a couple of, the talk is going to be split into two broad sections. The first is going to be about a sort of strategic thinking that goes into deciding to create a kiosk or architectural display, right? It's something that I think designers do better work when they have a sense of the strategic goals for why they're doing something, right? This is, of course, taking the user into consideration, but also understanding, what the purpose of what you're trying to achieve for your client or for the place in which something is being displayed. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the design considerations. And, there's been so much written and discussed around best practices for, how do you design for touch. I'm not going to talk a lot about the sort of the nitty-gritty of, how big your target size should be for touch. There's lots of places where you can go and learn about that. But instead, I'd like to get us thinking a little bit about what is the context for these interactions. So thinking about strategy. So if you think about the types of interactions which we have, which people used to have in public with institutions, right? So you go to the bank, you deal with a person. Now, you have this device that you walk up to, and banks are really trying to get you to use devices more and save that in-person interaction for signing up for new services and solving problems. But your day-to-day interaction is largely mediated today through devices, whether that's something in public like this or a mobile device. Same thing at the airport, right? We all remember what it was like to have to, we had all of those, the tickets that had all of the onion leaf carbon copies and so forth, and that required a lot of work for people to manage. Today, you can handle most of that, unless there's a problem through kiosks. And I think the retail environment is also changing. The charm of human interaction and having a shopkeeper help you with your purchase is something that is being usurped a little bit by devices. A client of ours, Target, they've resisted doing self-checkout partially because they believe that that sort of one-on-one interaction is really valuable, and other companies are making different decisions. So why is this happening? Why are we seeing more and more of these interactive installations, kiosks, and so forth as mediating devices in our public in interactions in businesses and out in the world? Well, obviously, the big reasons is money. Part of the reason why, people are saving money is to try to reduce headcount in stores, to try to if you have to think about the number of interactions that an individual is able to do, right? Somebody manning a counter versus a machine. The machine is often going to be a lot more efficient if it's designed properly. Space, obviously, it takes you can fit more kiosks than you can desks or stations for employees. And time. If you can, you know, the machines don't engage in small talk, right? They hopefully are speeding you through your task. But that's not really, you know, those are all, I think, a little bit, I want to say, a little bit cynical ways of looking at the reasons why somebody might put in a touchscreen into a public environment, right? I think it's a mistake to think, oh, well, it's just about efficiency. There are some other reasons, and an important one that we think about is that. So, every day, you know, we all engage with companies, kind of whether we like it or not, right? The clothing we wear, the devices we use, you know, the places we go, we are interacting with organizations. It could be a public organization, it could be a private organization. We're interacting with those with companies, and one of the challenges that people have are that businesses have a lot. They're much bigger than we are, right? I mean, a big focus of user-centered design has been trying to remedy this, right? Trying to get companies to think about people when they make their products, right? So that they're not just thinking about profit margin, they're not just thinking about efficiency, but they're also thinking about the lives of the people who purchase their products, with the goal of making people happier, solving problems, bettering society, right? And the blue line in this diagram is really the role that designers play, right? They create the things that are the interfaces that connect people to businesses, right? That's where we interact. So if you think about what businesses want, right? Well, they want really great results. They want to make more money. They want to expand. They want to grow. People. They want to have their problems solved. They want great experiences. They want to have emotionally satisfying experiences, right? They want to have products that they love. And so when you think about the type of design activities which people engage in, which we engage in to create both the great results for companies or the great experiences for people, it's marketing and product design. Now, a challenge with this for the designers here is that, is something you're really familiar with, is that marketing and product design are often at odds with one another in terms of craft, right? Product designers often look at marketers as kind of, you know, callow, empty, purveyors of puffery. Right, and marketers will look at product designers and think, well, these people don't live in the real world. It's like, you know, unless we can communicate something about, unless we can tell people what's wonderful about the product, nobody's going to buy it. So you think about the division between marketing and product design is really a matter of intent, right? So I'm a skier, and so when I look at Lindsey Vonn skiing here, I think about, like, I look at those skis and her boots and her helmet and goggles, and I think, wow, you know, I can relate to the experience that she's having or the experience that I could have using those products, right? It's all about the I'm thinking all about the experience. Right, so a product designer, the people who are designing the skis, the people who are designing the boots, the helmet, and so forth, they're thinking about how to create a great skiing experience, right? How they're thinking about how to enable Lindsey Vonn to cut a tenth of a second off of her race. Now, marketing, on the other hand, is all about communicating the emotion of it. It's like, wow, I want to be a rebel. I want to feel like I'm Bodie Miller, right? It's not necessarily. It has nothing to do, like, the design specs. That could be any ski that he's holding. It's just about, it's about communicating a brand message. So, another example, the famed Target pill case. So, an amazing product design, something that solves real problems, something that you know, ostensibly saves lives, right? Has a real tangible impact on people's on people's daily life, versus explaining that, right? I mean, the website doesn't help you not take your wife's pills accidentally, right? But it explains to you the value of that product. So if we have these two design activities of communicating brand messages or making things that people love, there's a question of like, how do you reconcile that? From my point of view, the most important thing you can do is to create great experiences, whether that's a great marketing experience or whether that's a great product experience. You know, those are both experiences which are generated and created by a company or an organization for their consumers. So if you look at, if you think about the a couple of different dichotomies, right? So branded communication, right, traditional marketing, user-centered design, something, you know, you're really focused on an object which could then be marketed in any number of ways for any, you know, Walmart in theory could have taken that Target pill bottle and made it theirs, right? It didn't have to be the Target bottle. And then you think about analog versus digital. So marketing has traditionally been very linear, right? TV spot being the kind of emblematic traditional branded communication. Product design also very linear, right? So advances in technology are having a really interesting effect on these, and this is where we're getting to touch, right? Because the putting devices that you can interact with in a public space is possible by certain advances in technology, right? By cheaper touch screens, by access to data, right? I mean, it's one thing to put a touch screen out in public, but if you don't have a way to connect it to information, you're going to have something which is going to require a lot of maintenance and so forth, right? So what this is doing is it's actually changing the way that marketing works, right? And it's making marketing more expressive, and it's making product design more useful. So when you have these, when you have a touchscreen out in public, when you have something which is built into a building, it kind of fits into this new space, right? Where the definition of it being marketing or the definition of being product design is a little bit fuzzy. It's hard to say what is what, right? So new ATMs, ostensibly they're product design, right? Because I use an ATM that's sort of what I pay my banking fees for. That's, you know, it's the thing I get access to, but it's also communicating a brand message. It's something that's out there in the world in the same way that a billboard is out there in the world, right? It's not my bank statement at home. It's not something private. It's a very public experience. So here, and talking about an example, so Target is Target's a retailer, obviously. What do they sell? Well, they sell a bunch of other products that people make, but what they really sell is their store, is the store experience. Why do you shop at Target? Well, price, of course, variety, the products that you're familiar with. But really, Target as an organization is really oriented towards curating a holistic experience that is kind of satisfying and different from something that you might expect at Costco or Walmart. And so how do they do that? Well, they have very carefully planned signage, right? The store layout, the way that the staff members are instructed to treat the guests, as they call them. And one of the things that they're doing is they're beginning to put interactive experiences into what has traditionally been a brick and mortar experience, purely brick and mortar, not digital. So this is a project that we designed for Target where on end caps within the video game section, the guest can learn about video games, can find them, and this is, it's a, the average target consumer is the, is you know, a 30-something mother who may or may not know anything about the games that their that her kids are wanting desperately for her to purchase, right? So how do you communicate that? Well, they could have a bunch of flyers, they could have posters, they could do a lot of that communication online, create a website for moms to go and research. But it's a really complex topic, and by putting a kiosk into that space, sacrificing really valuable shelf space, they're able to communicate with their consumer in a way that that they wouldn't have been able to previously. So this is a prototype that we built, and you know, we're using very, very simple gestures, right, to allow her to carousel through the different gaming consoles. So if you think about that paradigm of a vertically oriented touchscreen at the end of an end cap in the store, it says something about that, tells you kind of how to interact with it, right? Its orientation, its placement, its scale. It says, well, I'm a single user experience in a way that Surface Table is not. Now, Surface is something, when you think about the marketing product design dichotomy, obviously it's a product. Microsoft wants to sell Surface Tables. But it's also a tool for evangelizing a Microsoft experience, right? By, you know, Microsoft experiences have traditionally been very personal. I have it on my phone, I have it on my Zoom, I have it on my PC, I have it on the web, I have it in a sort of one-on-one experience, but by putting these devices out in public, they're allowing people to see other people using it, and they're allowing people who may or may not be Microsoft consumers to have an experience which is really dynamic and exciting and forward-thinking, right? So when you're designing something like that, so moving on from this idea from the topic of designing, making sure that you're designing something that fulfills a strategic goal, this is a handful of sort of best practices for touch design that I highly recommend. If you can go and download Dan Saffer's Tap is the New Click. It's a great presentation. He goes through all of this in real detail. The specific craft of designing a great touch experience is useless unless it's put into a public context in a way that people are actually going to use it, right? And that's what we're going to be talking about. So the first thing, the first rule about putting something into public is making sure that people understand that interactivity is possible. I was talking to a fellow earlier today who was saying, well, yeah, I played for half an hour on a slot machine last night before I realized that I could touch the screen, right? And there's no, you know, there's no clear, unlike the exit sign above that door, there's no common iconography, there's no stamp, there's no RSS icon that says, this is interactive, right? You think about the, like for instance, the touchless soap dispensers or faucets that you see in a bathroom, in public restroom, and they'll often have like a little image of a hand sort of saying wave, right? But that sort of way of communicating what's interactive or what isn't hasn't been standardized in any substantive way. So one of the most important things is to consider when the device is not being used, And it's something that is not, is kind of a non-standard experience, right? People expect to be able to interact with an ATM. They don't necessarily expect to interact with some 42-inch monitor that's hanging on the wall, right? It's very easy for people to be amazed to, they will just ignore completely those things. They'll think, oh, that's just some sort of digital signage. So when we designed this, the first way in which we designed the attract state was that we had this kind of ghost hand that you saw operating the UI, and there was a very kind of elegant, subtle touch to begin. And we wanted to explain to people, well, you know, yes, you can reach out and touch this. We wanted to show it. But when we deployed this into Target's test store in Edina, Minnesota, people didn't notice it. And this is something that is now being rolled out into well over 1,000 stores and a great expense. So we refined it to something which is much more obvious. Now, that blinking is something that, as a designer, it's not my favorite thing in the world, but people use it. There are probably some better ways to have executed that, but it was really effective. Now, this, I think it's really important to point out that this is all really new, right? There aren't that many of these screens out there. And I think that we will reach a point where more people expect, the default expectation is something that's touchable rather than the opposite, right? In the same way that now with mobile devices, unless you can, you know, if you have a screen and you can't touch it, it's kind of surprising. I think, you know, that I've seen people do that with the Kindle, right? They like pick up the Kindle and they try to swipe across. It doesn't work. So another example, we designed this huge wall that was at the Cannes Lions Advertising Festival last year, and it'll be again there this coming summer. It's 12 foot by 5 foot, really big. And we had all sorts of ideas around how to show the fact that it was interactable. And it's specifically, we had a challenge of showing the personalization feature. Now, this had RFID readers enable it, and we put RFID tags in every single conference attendee's badge, so when they walked up, the wall kind of recognized them. I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but one of our early concepts was sort of inspired by this artwork from the 90s from an artist named Jim Campbell, who was doing stuff with sensors, with sonic sensors, very early on, and this is LCD glass, and the idea is that as you see this object, as you walk up to it, the glass fogs up, and it kind of confounds your desire to see more, right? It's really wonderful and kind of haunting, and he does lots of great stuff with it. So we wanted to do the kind of inverse of that, right? To go from, rather than go from like clear to fuzzy, to go from fuzzy to clear. And so one of the early experiments which we did, which didn't work out, we figured with RFID signal strength, we could kind of gauge how far away people were from the wall. And the idea was that as you walk by, you would see your name kind of floating off in the distance. And as you got closer, your name would kind of come up to meet you and gain focus. It worked, but it didn't work at scale. This thing was really big, and when you had a dozen people crowding around it, it just, you know, we couldn't pull it off. And I'll talk a little bit about what we did in the end. So the next thing, which I think is really important, is to consider the context in which you're putting something, right? So there's lots of discussion these days around the augmented reality and creating mobile services which give you a perspective on your environment. The most successful, I think the most engaging successful installations in buildings or kiosks are ones that kind of acknowledge where you are, right? I always wish, right, that if I'm in a foreign airport and I'm checking in at a kiosk, I wish there was just an arrow telling me, like, do I turn to my left or do I turn to my right? To which way do I walk when I'm done, right? I mean, the kiosk should know where it's standing, and it should be able to point me in a direction. They don't, right? Edward Tufte tells this great story about a design that he did for while working for IBM, I believe, for the National Gallery, the Smithsonian, where somebody would walk up to this kiosk and print out a map, and it would take a photo of you standing in front of the kiosk and then do an overlay that shows where you want to walk. If you say, oh, I'm interested in seeing this gallery, that it would create a map that shows you in the map, right? It didn't get produced kind of ahead of its time, but designing something which is not just a web page inside of a touchscreen, right? Something that actually acknowledges where you are. You're in a space, right? Don't pretend that people aren't. So, coming back to Target, if you remember when you saw the animation of her swiping, the color, the color of the background swapped to be, you know, red or green or blue, depending on which platform you were looking at. That was done to reflect a new system of signage that had been designed for the video game section. So, you know, we could have, you know, there are lots of different ways that we could have referenced the categorization. We thought that it was really important to use the color, partially because, you know, you don't know the layout of these video game sections vary slightly from store to store, so it's hard to sort of give people instructions like go over to this aisle over here, right? So we needed some other graphic tool to explain that to people. For the can wall, one of the things that we did was we used the specific. Now, okay, so here's a separate separate topic from sort of information design and more about how do you create a design which references the location that you're at, right? So for the can wall, there was the can is this very kind of skinny city that is this coastal town. And we wanted to have a map you could touch on to get information about where parties were or restaurants and so forth. And what that did was, you know, we were very lucky because this wall was really, really long and it sort of fit naturally along the bottom. And so what we did is we put kind of place down there, and then time we were able to fit a Gantt chart, essentially, of the entire conference schedule up above, which kind of floating in the sky, in the heavens above Cannes. And then then we positioned the height of the wall to be so that open space between the map and the schedule was right at the sort of idealized height for interaction, right? So a few different things at play here, right? There's the graphic design, the layout. There's the positioning of the wall. There's looking at what people are paying attention to in that environment. It would have been very easy for us to create like a traditional vertical conference schedule on the left, and you could kind of go up and down there, and then have a big map on the right. But we wanted to do something that really reflected the environment. Now this is something which is a great strategy if you know where something is going. It's a little bit harder if you don't. The next thing that I think is really important to think about is to decide whether or not if you're in public, whether or not what you're doing is personal, right? Like an ATM where it's very private, or whether it's performative, right? So that you're standing there interacting with stuff and people are watching you from behind. So I think one of the, if you think about the spectrum of devices, and you'd probably put a tablet as this kind of fuzzy thing which travels from being something which is very personal to being kind of more public and shared, things get more and more public as they become put into a space and as they get larger, right? Partially because of scale and partially because of context. So this, if you think about operating your PC versus operating your TV, well, the TV, it's like I have a remote control, right? So I'm in control. It's just me. There, you know, somebody else doesn't have a dueling remote control trying to change channels, right? But if you're sitting with your friends, your family, you are kind of you are the conductor, right? You are somebody who is, you know, you, as much as you probably like to think that, oh, I'm going to do whatever I want, you have to consider the people sitting next to you. So another project we did a while ago back in 2006 was this pair of kiosks for JFK and O'Hare for Accenture. Now, this was a really, and so this had syndicated web content. It had stuff from Weather Channel and, you know, news from CNN and a wide variety of content that people could come up and kind of play with. Now, they were, those people, you know, when we designed this so that somebody who was waiting, you know, waiting for their next flight would come up and find something useful here. But and we created these essentially these two kiosks in one big display by creating these two stacks in space, right? So we created a very very kind of clear like a clear graphic layout that kind of told you, oh, you should stand here or you should stand here. Now, this is, this is dated now, you know, Tiger Woods, but and the whole golfing thing, but the real audience for all of Accenture's ads are not the sort of average users, the average travelers who are spending some extra time in before their flight fiddling with this neat tool, right? It's actually the C-level executives who are running to their next flight, walking by it in the distance, or on their way from the red carpet club to their gate, right? So if you saw the orientation, so we placed this in the same way that we placed the can screen to have, you know, the schedule, which is something that everybody wants to see, was just above people's heads, and there was a place for announcements up high. That was a strategy that we actually first encountered here at Accenture, because this whole thing is just marketing for Accenture to demonstrate how forward-thinking and innovative they are as a company. And so when we designed the interaction for pulling up news, well, we could have kept that really contained right in front of the user, right? Which is kind of what you'd expect. You're like, oh, I want to watch this, and I'm going to open up this little window, and it's going to be just mine, and I'm going to play with it. Instead, what we did is we kept the interactive area that you could touch in a very comfortable spot to avoid kind of gorilla arm, right? Where you have your arm up too long and your shoulder gets tired. But we had that stuff kind of bloom open and take up a much larger area that kind of surrounded the user, so that even if somebody couldn't read what the other person was looking at, that they saw that there was all of this interaction happening kind of around them, just demonstrating Accenture's kind of innovative character. So this is the lobby of the Comcast building in Philadelphia, and that is a gargantuan LED screen. I mean, it is massive, a couple stories high. It's really big. This photo doesn't actually give it kind of do it justice. I'm going to show a couple of sketches which we've done, concepts for this wall. We do a lot of work for Comcast on set-top box design and so forth, which hopefully will get released one day. So one of the things we wanted to do was to we're trying to come up with ways to make this experience interactive, right? Right now, it's just like a big TV screen, and it's incredible. People come there on their lunch break. Like construction workers will come there on the lunch break and just sit there. When Barack Obama was inaugurated, there's photos of it, and people are just packed, right? So it's fitting for Comcast in that it's a big TV screen, right? But we want to try to come up with a way to make it interactive. Now, one of the ideas that we had was to create a console, kind of like that would be back. If you see there's this big kind of stairwell at the bottom, you would be back behind, out of the flow of traffic. And the idea there is that you could choose the content that would appear up there and kind of fling it up to the wall, right? So you'd see this collection of content, and you could drag it up, and you could sort of, it's like you're throwing stuff up onto the wall. Other ideas are creating, you know, a puzzle piece, which... a puzzle where people can solve it, and you see it kind of solved up on the wall, or a Christmas tree at Christmas time where you could design your own decoration that would go up on this big virtual Christmas tree, and the tree would get larger and larger and larger as more and more ornaments got added. Now, this is something that's all very playful, doesn't serve any particular utile purpose, right? It's purely entertainment. But the idea here is that, well, you know, how do you do something performative in a big space like that, right? You have to have some mechanism. We've also talked about ideas where you could be using your body and have people sort of, you know, depending on we'd figure out where people were standing in the space and do some tracking of that and adjust that based on the traffic and in the lobby, but we thought that it was really important that, you know, that there be a focus. And one of the things that I think is particularly interesting about this is that by having this system where you're interacting with something in front of you and then it's getting projected separately, that you can divorce those two interactions at any time. So you can make it more or less performative, right? So there might be moments where the stuff up on the wall is just purely linear, but you still have this other screen that can be interacted with. So one of the challenges with something like that is like, well, how do people sort of decide what to, you know, when they walk up to something, how do they know what they can or can't do? Not in terms of the interface, but regarding other people. The ATM is a really, you know, it's really clear, right? You're like, you know that the person in front is private, and I don't know, different people maybe, you know, there might be a line that shows you how far back you're supposed to stand behind the person. He seems awfully close to her, I think, but... I think a more interesting analogy is the buffet or cafeteria line, partially because you have this, your tray kind of defines your physical space. It gives you, it's this object which says, okay, this is my spot, and I can feel the tray of the person next to me kind of bumping up against mine, pushing me along, and I can, you know, push the other person's along. A little more orderly than the security line at the airport with the buckets, right? Where it's never clear if you have them stacked up, if you're supposed to like hold the person back so you can put your other one down, right? So I think that if you're trying to create a multi-user environment, it's really important to come up with some analogies for yourself to figure out what are the rules, what are the rules for social interaction between people, right? How do people let each other know what they want to do, what they can do, what they can't do? Or you think about a bar where it's like, you know, you want to get to the bar to order a drink, and you have to kind of catch the eye of the bartender, and you have to kind of elbow your way in, literally get some elbow room, right? You know, are you trying to create something which is orderly, or are you trying to create something which is more freeform, chaotic? Surface table solves this really smartly in that it's a table, right? And tables are these surfaces that we're used to putting things on, right? So glasses. So if I want to put my glass down on a crowded table, it's kind of, everybody kind of understands, like, oh, mind if I move your glass and, you know, kind of squeeze in. In a digital environment, how do we do that? So the can wall was very much like a bar, right? I mean, it was this place where you had to kind of crowd in and figure out where to go. And we were able to solve some of the problems with software in that we knew where all of the objects were that were open on screen at any given time, and through RFID we kind of knew where the person was. And so we could place new widgets or new windows that got opened up smartly on screen, right? To kind of facilitate or ease it. But there were moments in which things had to overlap. You couldn't avoid it, right? So we had to figure out ways to allow people to ease, you know, if something opened up on top of theirs, to allow them to drag it to the side or tap theirs to bring theirs to the top of the stack. So it used a sort of common windowing system with some intelligence built into it to try to optimize the experience for multiple people. So another, I mean, a crucial topic which gets overlooked all the time is, you know, certainly it's been a long road to getting it acknowledged in web design and in kiosk and public interface design. When you have hardware, you can put Braille in it, right, underneath the buttons. But until we have haptics, until we have really good speech recognition that people understand in public how to engage with these devices, it's still really challenging. There's no really good answers yet. But one of the easy sort of the low bar of meeting accessibility standards in public is just in terms of orientation of the screen. So with the target touchscreen, one of the things we did was make sure that the entire interface could be operated from the bottom kind of half or lower third of the UI. So we had a grid, right, that kind of expanded in space, and you could scroll that, but you have these up and down buttons that move, that bring things down into that lower row so that somebody in a wheelchair can always reach that lower row, right? So we make sure that the entire device is usable in this very small area down here, even though the whole screen is touchable. We were pretty happy. I mean, it's worked out really well. Target has had a number of challenges with accessibility, as you may know, on the web, and this was something that we wanted to make sure that we addressed. I mean, I really wish there were some more standards for this stuff, and we're looking to try to push that forward. So this is coming back to the idea of like being at a bar or being in a buffet line. If you do something which, if you're creating an interface where one user's interactions can kind of interfere with somebody else's, you have to let people correct the situation, right, easily and quickly. So all of the, so, and this, and, and, And the question is, how do you tell people what the solution is for correcting it? So this is a detail of the widget, of the widgets that you can open up. So there were, you know, all the different objects on the screen that you could get details on, an event, a person, a place, all had these little standardized widgets. I'll talk a little bit more about that little drag tag thing, but we wanted to have this be kind of like a standard window, right? But it lacks scaling, right? You can't drag it open and make it bigger, partially because we didn't have time to develop that, but also because we wanted to encourage people to keep things as kind of tidy and small as possible, because we didn't want this to spread out. The header bar, we didn't want it to look like a standard operating system window, but we wanted to make sure that, you know, so I can, in the text area, I can scroll up and down or flick left and right on the images to page through if there are several images. But to drag it, we needed to, you know, it's the same type of rule that you might have for interaction design on the PC, where if you want to drag something, you need to have a handle or something, right, at the top of a window. But we needed to make that much thicker, that bar at the top of the window much thicker, so that you could touch it with your finger and drag it. Related to that is this issue of how do you, you know, if people abandon a UI, you don't want, you know, the next person who comes up needs to be able to interact with it very, very easily. And so a reason to avoid sort of like overly nested hierarchies, menus inside menus, is not just because somebody might come up and get lost, but also because they need to say, well, how do I, you know, where do I begin? And so I've seen some interfaces like this which have like modes on top of modes on top of modes, which is incredibly confusing. And by the time somebody cancels out of, you know, two modes to try to get back to the home screen or, you know, the start, and they can't do it, they're going to walk away, right? It has to be very, very easy to start over, right? And you can do that by having a big start over button, but even better, well, allow somebody to actually continue interacting with it rather than having to sort of hit reset. Last couple of things. So personalization is really, really hard in public environments because you don't have, you know, particularly multi-user environments, because how do you authenticate, right? Do you do that as a step within a process? So you say, you know, if you see share, or you see, email me this information as an option. Yes, you could have then a whole sort of sequential step where you, a series of steps where you have to fill out forms and you have to interact with it. But on a big touchscreen like that in public, where you are, you know, you don't want to necessarily show personal information, type in your phone number, type in your email address in public, while other people are kind of crowding around you, particularly because the scale of a QWERTY keyboard or something has to be big enough that it would necessarily be easier for somebody else to see. So one of the things that I think that there's room for a lot of innovation on, but there are some good interim solutions today are allowing people to sort of easily interact with the services that they already have that contain their personalized settings, right? So for instance, SMS, right? So if you SMS a short code, if you can generate short codes for individual interactions that you want to get information from the device, right? That's a way for you to enter in your personal contact information without actually entering it in on the device itself, because you use your phone for it. One of the things I'm most proud of with the CAN wall that we did was with the RFID was to solve this problem. So that's the. Actually, as an aside, that little spinny widget thing that says RFID underneath, completely unnecessary technically, right? We had four RFID readers behind the screen, and when you walked up to it, it would show you your name, and it would kind of pop up, and it would give you what we called your user avatar, which is basically kind of defined your personal workspace, because you could drag your avatar with you and kind of open up menus from it and so forth. But didn't need this comes back to the issue of showing interactivity. So because it said RFID underneath and it had this sort of spinny thing like it was reading it, even though, you know, the animation had nothing to do with anything, right? People would walk up with their badge and like pull it off their desk and like wave it in front of that little spinny graphic on screen. And it kind of told people that you could interact with it in an interesting way. So let me go back. So, oh yeah, that too. So the way that we solved the personalization and communication with other services that you had yourself in the CAN wall was we allowed, once you had this personalized widget, which was authenticated with your RFID tag, you could draw a connection between any two objects, right, between your avatar and any other object, and it would send you an email about whatever you were connecting to, right? And we, on the website, people were able to set up their preferences about how they wanted to be communicated with, right? So your RFID tag was like your key to all of the to all of your preferences, all of whether you wanted to be contacted by email, HTML email, plain text email, SMS, you name it, right? So we're pretty much out of time. One last thing. there's a lot that you can, you know, so no matter what you do in the screen, you have to consider the dressing around it, right? And if people are concerned about privacy, right, well, you need to design the housing or the distance or indications on the floor, lines to keep people back or whatever. You need to design that appropriately. In really public places, if you're having a screen which is being touched by lots of people, having hand sanitizer literally goes a long way towards making people feel comfortable about using something. And that's it. So, thanks very much.